Usually, when we think about building something massive, like, say, a 100-story skyscraper in the middle of a city, there's this inherent expectation of a heavily regulated process.
Right, yeah.
You have city planners, you have blueprints, you've got building inspectors walking the site every single day with their clipboards. You can't just build a tower in secret and then, suddenly open the doors to the public.
No, absolutely not. It's a highly visible process.
Yeah.
And with countless checkpoints, simply because the potential for catastrophic failure is just, oh, it's so high.
Right. But then you look at the world of frontier artificial intelligence, and we are essentially watching digital skyscrapers go up overnight.
Yeah.
Except it's like trying to inspect a skyscraper. But the developers just bought the city council and rewrote the zoning laws so you aren't like legally allowed on the sidewalk.
That is exactly what's happening.
And today, we're finding out who is actually paying to keep those inspectors away. First off, a huge thanks to Clinician Assist Tank for supporting this deep dive into the August 20, 2026 issue of Conversational AI Watch. We're pulling apart issue number 132 today
Yes, we are.
to really try and cut through the immense hype surrounding AI and look at the actual state of play. We want to know who is trying to write the rules, the unbelievable amounts of money being spent to stop them, and where everyday consumers are being left completely exposed in the gap between those two forces.
And, just to set the ground rules for our listeners before we really jump in here, we are unpacking the facts directly from our source material today.
Right.
So when we discuss specific political candidates or laws or, super PACs, we are strictly maintaining an impartial tone.
Absolutely.
We're not endorsing any candidate or policy. We're just reporting on the dynamics driving this industry.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand how terrified the AI industry is of actual guardrails,
Right.
we have to look at what they're doing to one local politician in New York.
Yeah, this is our lead story today.
Right, so the focus is Alex Bors. He's a Democratic member of the New York State Assembly representing a Manhattan district. And last December, he authored this piece of legislation called the RAISE Act. Governor Kathy Hochul signed it, and it goes into effect on January 1st, 2027. Now, Bors is currently running for the U.S. House.
Right, in the Democratic primary for New York's 12th district.
Yeah. And in response to this congressional run, an industry-backed super PAC called Think Big, which is funded by a group called Leading the Future, they launched this massive opposition campaign. And I know they threw a staggering amount of money into this race, but do we have the exact figures on what they've spent just to stop him?
We do. And it is the number is $8,145,699.
Wait, $8 million
Yeah.
in a local state primary for one single candidate.
Over 8 million. And we really need to pause on the exclusivity of that number too, because
Nah.
every single dollar of that super PAC's opposition budget this entire cycle has targeted this one individual.
You're kidding.
No, I mean, they have supported other candidates, certainly, but Bors is the absolute only one they have spent money to explicitly oppose.
Okay, why is he such a threat?
Yeah.
I mean, he wrote a state-level safety bill, right? What did Bors actually put in this RAISE Act that made him public enemy number one to the point where they're dropping $8 million just to ruin his primary chances?
Well, the source notes, it is the first state law testing frontier models on a, quote, compute threshold.
Okay.
Specifically, it targets models trained on 10 to the 26th floating point operations, which is essentially a $100 million compute cost.
Oh, wow.
So if a company crosses that line, they are legally required to publish a highly specific safety protocol. And if there is a safety incident, they are mandated to disclose it within 72 hours.
Okay, before we get into the whole disclosure part, explain the mechanism here for someone who, doesn't build data centers for a living. What exactly is a compute threshold, and why use that as the trigger instead of just, I don't know, regulating based on a company's revenue or how many users they have?
Right. Well, it is a brilliant legislative mechanism.
All
And
right.
honestly, that is exactly why the industry sees it as a massive threat. Compute refers to the sheer processing power, the floating point operations or FLOPs that are required to train the AI model.
Okay.
Think of it like regulating cars based on the horsepower of the engine rather than the brand name on the hood or the bank account of the manufacturer.
Oh, sick.
Yeah, so when you train a model with 10 to the 26th operations, you are creating something immensely powerful, regardless of whether you are a trillion-dollar tech giant or just a brand new startup operating out of a garage.
Right, because regulating by company size creates massive loopholes. I mean, a tiny startup with huge venture funding could build a highly dangerous model and completely escape a revenue-based law just because they haven't sold any subscriptions yet.
Exactly. Bohr's law regulates the physics of the system itself.
It targets capability.
It does. And Bohr is fully aware of why he is being targeted.
No.
He is actually quoted saying they plan to spend at least $10 million against him because he is their biggest threat.
Damn.
This POC is heavily backed by the largest AI venture firm in the world and the president of OpenAI. This is an eight-figure market signal to investors. The Frontier Labs are demonstrating just how much they value preempting any state-level testing regimes.
Right, because if Bohr wins and goes to Congress, he carries the only tested compute threshold law in the country right into the federal chamber. Like, he could turn one state's rule into the national floor.
Which is an existential threat to an industry that is very accustomed to moving fast and breaking things without, you know, any regulatory friction.
Well, let's assume he does make it to Washington. He's going to walk into a federal approach to AI regulation that our source paints as completely dysfunctional.
But not early.
Congress currently has several bills in play touching online safety and chatbots. There's the YARD Act, the Chatbot Act, and COESA, the Kids Online Safety Act.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a massive gap in all of them regarding mental health.
Yes, there is.
None of these bills require a licensed clinician when a chatbot detects it is talking to a user in crisis. And none of them have any dedicated funding for enforcement.
Yeah.
Wait, they are trying to regulate mental health chatbots, but forgetting to include actual doctors in the bill?
I know.
That feels like regulating airplanes, but forgetting to mention pilots.
What's fascinating here is that lawmakers are completely struggling with the actual mechanics of enforcement. We can look at the senators sponsoring these bills, Hawley, Cruz, Blackburn, purely as actors within the legislative process.
Right.
They are writing bills that gate age and require parental consent, but they are entirely missing the clinical reality of what happens when a user is in acute distress. The Chatbot Act, for instance, relies on something called a, quote, reasonable efforts conduct standard.
Reasonable efforts.
Yeah, companies just have to prove they tried to prevent their chatbots from sharing obscene content or materially assisting suicide.
They don't actually have to succeed. A standard of effort is incredibly weak when dealing with automated systems at scale. But then you look at the GUARD Act, which is much stricter.
Yeah.
It bars minors from access entirely and criminalizes designs soliciting self-harm.
Right.
But it has been stalled on the Senate calendar for over 100 days because of a legislative rule called the Unfunded Mandates Reform Act, or UMRA.
Yes, UMRA. So UMRA allows any senator to raise a floor objection against a bill that costs the private sector more than roughly $218 million a year without providing a funding source.
Okay.
And GUARD almost certainly crosses that cost threshold, so the bill is just paralyzed.
Wait, I want to push back on this UMRA rule a bit. It stalled the GUARD Act, sure.
Yeah.
But isn't preventing unfunded mandates actually a good thing? Like, we don't want the federal government forcing the private sector or the states to spend hundreds of millions of dollars they don't have, right? That seems like a responsible check on legislative overreach.
The intent behind UMRA is absolutely about fiscal responsibility. But the reality of its application in the tech sector creates a systemic paralysis.
How so?
Well, when you apply a 1995 legislative mechanism to a 2026 frontier AI market, you just run into massive scale issues. Building compliance frameworks for systems interacting with hundreds of millions of users daily is inherently expensive.
Oh, I see.
So if every robust safety bill is killed because it crosses a static dollar threshold, you end up regulating nothing.
So how do you bypass it? There has to be a way to mandate safety without triggering that block.
There is a proposed fix floating around called the 988 Safe Act. It proposes a 3% user fee on covered chatbot revenue over $5 million.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that fee would bypass the unfunded mandate issue by generating its own revenue, which would then fund a real-time warm handoff to a trained 988 counselor when a conversation crosses a crisis threshold.
See, that actually solves the funding mandate and puts a human expert in the loop.
Yes.
Meanwhile, while the federal government is stuck trying to figure out funding mechanics, the states are simply acting. California SB 903 is hitting the assembly floor soon.
In like 11 days, yeah.
Right. And it requires either actual licensed clinician review or formal regulatory clearance before a chatbot can market itself as therapy. And it's enforced by state health licensing boards that already have their own funding structures.
Exactly. States are pricing in real compliance and leveraging existing healthcare infrastructure. Federal bills are just stalling out over administrative hurdles and completely ignoring the medical reality of the services being offered by these models.
So if the federal laws are stalled out, what is happening in real life right now? Because the lack of clinician involvement isn't just a theoretical policy problem on Capitol Hill.
No, it's not.
It is happening today inside hospitals. According to the stat report in our source, massive health systems are deploying language models directly against live patient records. Stanford Healthcare has a system called Chatty HR, Penn Medicine has Chart Hero, and Hartford Healthcare has Patient GPT.
And these systems aren't just drafting generic appointment reminders either. They are querying the actual medical chart. And the stat report claims these tools, quote, increase diagnostic accuracy.
Here's where it gets really interesting. What is their evidence for that massive claim? I mean, claiming an AI improves diagnostic accuracy requires massive peer-reviewed clinical trials.
You would think so. But the evidence cited in the report rests entirely on one single physician's quote about one single missed cancer diagnosis that the chatbot happened to catch.
Are you serious? An exclamation point at the end of a doctor's quote is not a clinical sample size.
It really isn't.
There are zero studies cited, zero trials, just an anecdotal success story driving the narrative. How is this different from the AI medical scribes we've seen in the past?
We really need to clearly distinguish between the surfaces here. In previous iterations of clinical AI, an algorithm might, say, draft a reply to a patient, but a human doctor reads it, edits it, approves it, and importantly, the patient is explicitly informed that AI was used to draft the message.
Right. That is a human-in-the-loop system.
Yes. But what we're seeing now with Chatty HR and Chart Hero is a fundamental shift. These tools are silently reading the entire medical record. They are synthesizing decades of complex, nuanced patient history.
And doing it without formal federal oversight. Doesn't the government have a framework for benchmarking medical AI devices?
There is a pending framework, FDA 2026-N7874, proposing benchmarking and confirming generative AI medical devices in the clinic before they ever reach a patient. But these current deployments are bypassing that entirely.
Wow.
Furthermore, the source notes, there's no reported patient disclosure. You could go to the hospital and a chatbot could be mining your entire medical history, making diagnostic inferences without you ever consenting to or even knowing about that process.
The liability issues alone are staggering. Investors are backing tools making severe diagnostic claims without the data to back them up, operating outside a pending federal framework.
Yeah.
It shows how fast deployment is outpacing both the science and the law. But this raises a broader question. If consumers' highly sensitive health data is being mined silently in clinics, what happens to our regular everyday chat data?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is where we see a massive divide between the enterprise pipeline and the consumer surface. Big tech is building incredibly sophisticated safety architectures, but only for the people who pay the biggest bills.
Okay, explain that.
On August 19th, OpenAI reaffirmed a policy of zero data retention for its frontier models, and they previewed a new system called Private Safety Processing, or PSP.
Okay, explain how PSP works. Because on the surface, privacy sounds like a win for everyone.
Well, PSP is designed to catch multi-step misuse without OpenAI ever having to read the customer's raw prompts. The data stays entirely on the customer's infrastructure. The AI essentially evaluates the safety of the request locally. It is a brilliant piece of engineering.
Okay.
But the critical detail is that this is strictly available for enterprise and API customers, early corporate testers like Microsoft and Databricks.
So the consumer version of ChatGPT, the app that regular people use every day, the app that generated the recent tragic harm cases involving a 0.15% rate of suicidal ideation conversations, that app gets none of this protection.
None. They're building bespoke privacy architectures to protect the intellectual property and regulatory compliance of their massive corporate clients while leaving the general public completely vulnerable on their main consumer app.
It's like an automaker selling a fully armored blast-proof car to a bank, but, you know, leaving the seatbelts out of the family minivan. The consumer absorbs all the risk.
That's a great way to put it.
But what makes this even more complex is how different companies are approaching the business-to-business side. Anthropic is taking the exact opposite approach for its most capable models. They are demanding a 30-day retention log for enterprise customers.
Right.
Why would Anthropic require a 30-day log while OpenAI boasts about zero retention?
It comes down to the fundamental tension between data minimization, which is privacy, and threat detection, which is security.
Oh, okay.
Anthropic requires that 30-day log so they can trace real, complex, multi-step cyber attacks after the fact. If a malicious actor uses the AI to write polymorphic malware over the course of, say, 3 weeks, You need a forensic trail to understand how they do it and patch the vulnerability. You cannot trace a multi-step attack if you have zero data retention.
So OpenAI is optimizing for privacy guarantees to win enterprise sales, telling companies, you know, we will never look at your data. Mm. Meanwhile, Anthropic is optimizing for forensic security, telling companies, we need a record in case things go wrong. Both make logical sense for corporate clients, depending on their specific needs. But again, the actual public using the free or standard paid versions of these apps gets left out of the equation entirely.
And if consumers don't get the enterprise shield, we have to look at the safety features companies are legally forced to build for the public.
Right.
Often these are driven by international law. But as our source outlines, even when those features are mandated, they turn out to be incredibly fragile.
This brings us to the European Union's AI Act.
It does. Article 50 of the EU AI Act requires AI-generated text to be machine-detectable. To satisfy this regulatory requirement, Anthropic launched an invisible watermark called Synthid Text on August 14th.
Wait, before we talk about what happened to it, how do you even watermark text?
Yeah, it's tricky.
It's not like stamping a translucent logo over a photograph or hiding an audio frequency in a song. How does an AI hide a signature in plain words?
It is a fascinating cryptographic technique based on token probability. When a large language model generates text, it doesn't just pull full sentences out of thin air. It predicts the next most likely chunk of a word, which is called a token.
Okay.
Usually, it picks the most probable token. A text watermark manipulates that probability distribution. It forces the AI to occasionally pick, say, the third most likely word, creating a specific mathematical pattern of slightly less probable word choices throughout the text.
Oh, wow.
To a human reader, the sentence makes perfect sense. But to a detection algorithm looking at the math, that subtle pattern of suboptimal word choices is a clear statistical signature.
So it's weaving a mathematical code into the vocabulary itself. That sounds incredibly robust.
It sounds robust, but it lasted exactly 5 days in the wild.
5 days.
5 days. By August 19th, three independent coders had published workarounds to completely strip the watermark. And they did it under their real names. It wasn't some shadowy, state-sponsored hacker collective using supercomputers. It was just regular coders experimenting.
The methods they used to break it are what absolutely astound me.
Yeah.
Leon Klon at Oxford just used a round-trip translation. He translated the watermark text to Arabic, translated it back to English, and the watermark was entirely gone. Because translating the text destroys the specific mathematical pattern of English tokens.
Right.
No complex coding required.
None at all. Then you have Eric Hughes, who used Claude itself. He simply prompted the AI to rewrite the text and swap some synonyms, effectively scrambling the probability distribution. He broke the watermark in 15 minutes.
Wait, one guy built a lockpick 3 days before the lock was even invented, right?
Right, that was Yo Meyer. He built an open source model designed to rewrite text specifically to evade detection. And he published his tool 3 days before Anthropic even launched the watermark.
That is almost embarrassingly simple.
Mm.
One guy translates it to Arabic and back. Another guy builds a tool before the watermark is even out.
This raises an important question and exposes a massive flaw in the regulatory language itself. The EU AI Act asks for detection, quote, as far as this is technically feasible. What these three coders proved in under a week is that, currently, a robust, unremovable text watermark might not be technically feasible at all. The foundational technology simply doesn't support the legal requirement yet.
And there is a massive caveat to all of this. No one can actually prove these workarounds mathematically beat Anthropic's internal detector. Well, simply because Anthropic hasn't released the detector to the public.
Exactly.
The coders know they disrupted the statistical pattern they can observe, but there's no public API to verify the failure. So we have an EU-mandated safety feature broken by synonym swaps and translations, and nobody can even formally audit the failure rate because the testing tool is kept as a corporate secret.
It demonstrates how incredibly fragile these compliance workflows are. If a government regulator or a massive hospital system is trusting a compliance label that relies on this watermark, they are leaning their entire liability structure on a technology that couldn't survive a single week on the open internet.
So, what does this all mean? If watermarks break in 5 days, consumer safety tools don't exist, and Congress is stalled out over 1990s funding rules, why does the AI industry seem so relentlessly optimistic?
Yeah.
It feels like they want us to look everywhere except at the current problems.
They do.
They want us to focus on the shiny, overpromised future.
We saw a perfect example of this timeline manipulation recently at an event called Internapalooza on August 10th. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman was asked when a truly context-aware AI would arrive. He told the audience that a descendant of ChatGPT could watch a user screen all the time, sit in on every meeting, and record every call within 6 months.
6 months. He is promising an omniscient digital assistant that sees everything you see, hears everything you hear, and contextualizes your entire life by next February. But let's look at the reality of the technology they're actually shipping today.
Let's do that.
The current product, ChatGPT, for macOS's new computer history feature, is off by default. It only logs text events, meaning clicks and keystrokes. It has absolutely zero image or audio capture capabilities.
And the gap between the shipped product and the executive promise is vital for lawmakers to understand. Altman is forecasting full-time screen, audio, and video surveillance as an imminent reality. Interestingly, Meta announced screen sharing for its own chatbot in that exact same week.
Right.
So we are looking at a clear industry-wide trend of these companies demanding unprecedented continuous access to our personal devices.
Altman is painting a sci-fi movie that's supposedly 6 months away, while the actual app right now is basically just a glorified text logger. It functions as a brilliant distraction technique. It sends a message of, you know, don't look at the fact that our safety watermarks break in 5 minutes or that our clinical chatbots are silently reading unanonymized medical charts. Look at this futuristic, all-knowing assistant we're building.
Which is why the critical advice for both lawmakers drafting policy and engineers building these tools is strictly this. Regulate and build around what actually ships today. Do not draft federal laws based on a CEO's fireside chat prediction of what might exist in 6 months. The current reality is a text-only opt-in scope with massive unresolved vulnerabilities. If we base our legal frameworks on future promises, we completely ignore the active harms happening right now on the consumer surface.
And that brings us full circle to why you, the listener, need to care about all of this. Because you are the one living right in that gap. You are sitting in the space between the utopian promises the AI industry makes, the flawed, unregulated reality of what the technology actually does today, and the utter lack of laws protecting you while you interact with it.
The rules governing this technology are being written, but they are being written slowly, clumsily, and there are incredibly well-funded forces actively trying to ensure they never see the light of day.
Which leaves me with one final thought for you to chew on. Think back to the start of this deep dive. If an AI super PAC is willing to drop over $8.1 million into a local state primary to completely destroy the career of one single assemblyman just for writing a basic safety law, well, what happens when they start aiming that kind of money at the independent researchers and coders, like the three guys who broke the watermark, who exposed the fundamental flaws in their technology? When the building inspector gets crushed, who protects the people pointing out the cracks in the foundation? We'll leave you with that. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.